Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Sally Asher, whose new book is Stories from the St. Louis Cemeteries of New Orleans. We'll also hear from poet Laura Mullen, director of the Creative Writing Program at Louisiana State University. Her new book is Complicated Grief. Historian and photographer Sally Asher is a writer and a dog lover and a retired Big Easy roller girl. At Mardi Gras, you can see her perform as co-captain of the Légerettes, the marching crew honoring Princess Leia of Alderaan. She's the author of Hope in New Orleans, A History of Crescent City Street Names, a wonderfully witty and smart guide to some of our Crescent City avenues. And now she's back with Stories from the St. Louis Cemeteries of New Orleans, a guide to the cities of the dead. Sally, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
This book is so much fun. And I love that there are so many stories in just these three cemeteries. So how did you narrow it down from all these graveyards to these three?
It was kind of a matter of picking. I originally had 13 cemeteries. Mm-hmm. And I started with St. Louis number 3 because it was near my house. And then when I started gathering more information, and then I went from 3, 2, and 1, and then originally cut it to just the saints, including St. Patrick, and then realized that I was only going to barely squeeze in 1, 2, and 3, and that was all I could handle.
And how did you do this work? I mean, did you spend lots of times in the cemeteries looking at all the graves and making notes, or did you work from rolls from the Archdiocese? How did you come up with your
It was
choices?
A combination. A lot of it was pounding the pavement, walking back and forth and finding tombs. A lot of it was archival newspaper articles, various books, scholarly articles. I love looking through legal court cases to find drama there. It was kind of a combination of all things. And it was definitely fueled, I think, by listening to so many tour guides over the years describe some of the stories. And I got a little tired of accosting visitors when they would come into the cemeteries. I was kind of like the tour guide that you didn't expect. That I would just walk up to people and say, do you know who you're standing in front of? Do you know who you're photographing? And so I was chosen to be a guest lecturer on Royal Caribbean Cruise Line, which I had no idea that they did at the time. And you go in and you do 3 different lectures while you're out at sea. And that was the first time I had lectured to people who weren't from New Orleans. Uh-huh. So I realized that a lot of the terminology I used, they had no idea. They didn't know what a second line was. You know, they didn't know what a year and a day. They didn't know what a faubourg was. And they seemed to be most interested in the cemeteries. And when I started doing research, realized that most of the books were architecturally based or were beautiful photographs that wouldn't even identify what the graves were or where they were or who was in them. And I started to realize that, especially with a lot of the vandalism that has been happening, that hopefully people will gain a greater appreciation if they know the people who are buried, you know, within these cemeteries and know what they did and know what their footprint was. So I tried to be very conscious of course, you know, covering the rock stars like Marie Laveau and, you know, Ernie Cato to people that you might not know or be aware of.
Yeah. And it's interesting that they have such a place in the popular consciousness, you know, and a lot of that comes from Easy Rider, from the movie.
Yes. That was kind of a double-edged sword for the cemetery. It brought the St. Louis Cemetery number 1 kind of unwanted publicity. And they went in there and they filmed without permission of the Archdiocese. And if you've seen the movie, which I believe came out in 1969, Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper pretty much go into St. Louis number 1 and have this LSD-induced booze sex romp within the cemetery. And so after that, the Archdiocese put their foot down and said no more filming in St. Louis number 1. So when I was doing the research, and that's a fairly famous story, I wanted to find a different angle. And I found this local character who was actually in the movie, and his name was Paul Ernest. and he was classically trained. He would randomly stand outside of people's balconies and sing opera to them. And so somebody told Dennis Hopper, you've got to go and see this guy perform. And he would go to an obscure bar on Bourbon Street, and Ernest would perform from Shakespeare, like pass the hat, to just really like drunk, bleary-eyed, you know, haze of smoke and highballs. He would stand there and perform Shakespeare and pass his hat around and maybe make like $5 or $6 per night. And so Hopper loved him and said, I need to cast you in this movie. So if you see the movie, he is dressed in a black suit and carrying an umbrella and reading from the Bible in the cemetery. So that was a local character during that time.
And that's a wonderful story to unearth. I mean, it brings it all back home. So talk a little bit about Marie Laveau, too. And I'm interested in the crew of Nick's story, which I thought was so endearing.
Well, Marie Laveau, as they say, is probably the second most visited tomb in America next to Elvis Presley.
Oh, yeah.
And there's so much myth and legend, you know, involving around Marie Laveau. But there's this great story, you know, before the Archdiocese shut down, number one, to visitors without, you know, tour guides or family members, there was always offerings and cross. So the crew of Nick's went in to leave an offering that they would not have rain on their parade day in 2012. And they left it at the wrong tomb. And it rained that year and a couple years after the fact. So we're like, coincidence? I don't know. The year that they got it right was the first year it did not rain for the ladies of Nick's.
Now, not everyone is quite so well known. And I loved hearing the story of Jordan Noble.
The drummer boy. He was interesting. He went through four wars and four marriages, which can almost be the same thing, depending on who you talk to. And they credited him with doing the drum roll that kept Jackson's troops going on January 8th, 1850 on the Chemappe battlefield. And he became very beloved to New Orleans. And he started a tradition that every New Year's Day, he and his band would go out and play the same tune on his drum and salute the different officers and the mayors. And when he died, they ran a picture of him and did a very, very lengthy article on him, which was rare for that time.
Oh, yeah.
During basically the Reconstruction era.
And he inspired a wonderful children's book by Freddie Evans, too.
There needs to be more about him.
I'm glad.
I'm glad.
And then one of my very favorite figures from Louisiana history, because I think it's such a romantic story, is Falcor Aime. And I never realized he was buried in New Orleans.
Yeah, he was buried originally in I believe it was St. James Parish. And he came in the 1920s. His remains were moved. And he was known as the Louis XIV of Louisiana. And he had this giant plantation, which they called Little Versailles. It was about 40 acres. And the way that they described this, I got a lot of descriptions, some from the WPA, some from former interviews with slaves. And he had a gardener and peacocks strolling the grounds and swans and Chinese temples. And he would have one of his slaves go out to the road at every time, specific time around noon. And if you happened to be traveling by, he would stop and invite you in for dinner. And he won a bet that he could produce everything on his plantation for a meal, including cigars and coffee. And his entire meal came from his plantation. He won the bet.
And he was a grieving widower and father for a long time.
Yes. When the Union Army came and took over New Orleans in 1862, they tended to destroy most of the plantations. But aside from destroying some of the grounds that were destroyed by shells, he was still grieving strongly from losing many of his children and his wife.
Yeah.
And so they let him stay. And his grandson, who was Alcée Fourchet, recalls standing on the grounds when the shell hits of his grandfather's plantation. And he's buried with him as well in the same tomb. He made it there first in that specific tomb, I believe in 1914. And then 1919. Aimé's remains were moved in that tomb as well.
It's such the Lost Gardens of Falcor Aime. You know, I mean, it's just such a story. I have always loved that. And it's so lovely that you do bring them to life in this book. This is like writing lots of obituaries in a way.
I read a lot of obituaries while studying this. And, you know, for those, like I said, who were more known, you try and say, okay, well, you know, how can you bring a different light to them? And so, for example, like Dutch Moriel, I focused on the 1970s police strike during his time. So sometimes I use people to tell specific stories. But there are so many amazing stories and so many forgotten people, and especially if they were popular during their time, the obituaries tend to be very rich, and you can start from there and move on.
So why do you think people come to visit these cemeteries when they don't really have that connection with the people in them?
I think because they're unique. I think there's a lot of aesthetic pleasure in the beauty and in the decay. I tend to be drawn to both. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I will sometimes find people wandering in number two, and I just walk up and start spouting information to them, whether they want it or not, and then start showing them the different tombs. And they say, I never knew that. And I think when you have something that's so awe-inspiring and so beautiful that you tend to forget, you know, like I said, these are people. These are people who were important. And a lot of them were just passer-throughs, you know, that were very brief here, like Eliza Claiborne, who was here, who had an amazing story with her brother, who died in a duel over her honor after she passed. And they've made their mark, and they deserve respect. I think sometimes stories stay with you longer than what a specific decoration on a tomb is called or what year it was built. And so I hope that people will have a greater appreciation by knowing who these people are.
And who was the biggest surprise to you? Who was the one person you might not have known anything about or might have discovered in the course of this research?
Andre Callio, who I believe should be on the lips of every New Orleanian who should be known. He was amazing. He was a former slave who purchased his freedom at the age of 21. His owner allowed him to freelance, I guess you could say. He was a cigar maker, and he prided himself in being the blackest man in New Orleans. And he was this very imposing figure and a good boxer. And he was one of the only black officers in the Union Army, and especially to see battle. And he basically was sent on a suicide mission to secure Port Hudson. And they had the advantage of 300 feet. And he was shot and killed. And during this time, it was common that there would be a ceasefire for people to be able to gather their dead or wounded. But the Confederates refused because they were black and kept sharpshooters on him for, I believe, about 41 days. Until he was been pulled from the field. And they gave him an enormous funeral. He was a hero. They said it was the first time that free people of color and slaves and whites came out. And his funeral was held by a white priest who was basically kicked out of the church because he was against slavery. And all these Callio Leagues were formed. He was this very inspirational figure for blacks to gain their way to citizenship. And he's basically been lost to time. But a lot of the people of Reconstruction era were mainly reside in St. Louis No. 2, were a huge thrill to find, and their influence in what they've done.
Well, this is a book that's full of great stories. It's full of life, of course, like our cemeteries are, as we know. Beautiful pictures, great stories.
What
more can you want? We've been talking with Sally Asher, whose great new book is Stories from the St. Louis Cemeteries of New Orleans. Sally, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
It's such a pleasure to welcome poet Laura Mullen to The Reading Life. Laura is one of the most interesting and challenging poets I know, and she has one of the most demanding literary jobs in our state as well, directing the prestigious creative writing program at Louisiana State University. Today we'll be talking about her most recent book, her eighth, which is called Complicated Grief. Laura, welcome to The Reading Life.
Susan, thank you so much for inviting me onto the show.
Oh, long overdue, girl. Now, Complicated Grief is actually a clinical term, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a term for the kind of traumatic grief that you can't get out of. You're stuck in. You've got to replay it over and over and over again. A good example, it seems to me, would be the example from literature, which is Dickens' Miss Havisham from Great Expectations.
Oh, yes.
Where instead of moving on with her life, she stops everything. She's a jilted bride. She stays in her wedding clothes, lets the feast rot around her, and just tries to make sure that other people are as unhappy as she is.
Oh, yes, indeed. And everybody has this clear mental picture of her, you know? It fascinates me.
Oh, yeah, no. She's a great kind of avatar, I think, for this sort of extended mourning. And it's something that a lot of people are coping with. And as grief experts say, it's like Louis Armstrong talking about jazz. If you don't know what it is, you're never going to know.
Right.
With complicated grief, if we're having to explain it to you, you're probably not feeling it, but if you're in it, you know, because you feel stuck and you can't get out.
I've started to think lately that grief is the great subject matter of our time. You know, I've read so many amazing books, particularly this year, like H's for Hawk.
Yes.
One of those stunning memoirs of grief. It's interesting to me.
I think we, as a culture, that we have kind of piled up a load of grief that we haven't dealt with.
And we're going to have to deal with it sooner or later.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that interests you in your writing formally is the idea of hybrid forms. So talk about the hybrid forms that are in complicated grief.
Such a good question. I guess the easiest way to talk about it is to say the forms we have are just forms that people invented, and we tend to think of them as very, very important, recognized forms, but they coexist with a lot of material that doesn't fall neatly into novel or poetry. There's a wonderful scholar named Martha Nell Smith who's written beautifully about the way we have kind of sabotaged Emily Dickinson. In fact, there's no proof that her poems should have been removed from the letters they were set in. Emily Dickinson, in fact, may have been writing hybrid work long before our ability to recognize it.
Wow.
Certainly someone like Jean Toomer, the wonderful hybrid book Cain, is pointing away in this direction in the 1930s. I'm forgetting the date of that book. But then we have a raft of people in the contemporary literary scene, as you know, all saying, well, I don't see why this impulse, the poetry impulse, should be separated from the narrative impulse, should be separated from nonfiction, should be separated from images.
So this book is a little bit of everything. I mean,
it is. It really is. I was very proud of my publishers with their decision to say, okay, it's a memoir, because
yes,
that was edifying for me. Because once I took the fabulous fiction, the poetic prose, and the nonfiction in the book and put them together and saw them as a memoir, I realized, yes, in fact, this is a way of telling my life story.
And it's a very brave book.
Thank you.
It must have been very hard to write.
Well, you're so kind. I'm just going to say, I wish I'd been able to do it sooner.
Yes.
You know, maybe that's the answer we all have for this, but it takes a while to get to bravery, and I'd love to help others get there quicker.
Now, part of this is about a very devastating breakup, and there's this wonderful description. I kept looking down at the empty space beside me as though there were a book there in which I could read myself, my own heart. And I think books are important in that part of the story, which I loved.
Thank you. That's a marvelous thing to pull out of the text. In some ways, this book is not only a story of my life, but it's also a story about reading.
Absolutely. That's what I love about it.
Yeah, it is. It's a story about a love of literature and how literature can both save us, and then also it tells us stories and we match our own lives to those stories we've seen, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse.
Yes. But there were so many stories that it's so surprising, the range of references in this book. And I don't know why I say it's surprising, because anybody who reads as much as you and I do has that kind of weird library internally, you know. Like Gertrude Stein, for example, is important to you.
Yeah, absolutely. But so is Roland Barthes, and so is Edgar Allan Poe and Emily Dickinson. And like you, I can't hear a line that sounds something like a line I've heard without this little chime going off in my head and going, oh, yes.
That's true.
If you say to me, thirst quenched, I immediately think of Alice in Wonderland.
See? And then, of course, there are the fairy tales that inform this book, particularly Little Red Riding Hood.
Indeed.
I love fairy tales.
Me too. I devoured them when I was a child.
Well, that's the right word for it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I devoured them, and then they devoured me, right?
Well, I want to give people who are listening a sense of what this book sounds like when you read it. And I wonder if you'd read just that paragraph, because I love it so much.
I'd be so happy to, and I just want to say how happy I was that you isolated this gorgeous paragraph, which is in the middle of the story Red, and I should say that's spelled R-E-A-D.
Yes, thank you.
It's a little play on Red Riding Hood. And the whole piece is my reconsideration of that fairy tale from a number of different directions, and here we go. The story is not really hers at all, is it? It's the story of the woods, in some way, the story of the space between girlhood and old age, the space of a sexuality defined in terms of its social usefulness. Fecundity is key, of course. Yawn. The tangled edge of the forest she enters defines a space of visibility and vulnerability to predatory desires. In this reading, by the time she arrives at grandmother's house, she is her grandmother. Loose skin, blasted veins, wrinkles, the whole nine yards, as we say. You know, what's that flapping as I move my arm? Oh, God, it's my arm itself. Horrible. Or so the culture is quick to inform her. But in between? In that long wander through flickering leaf light, the air thick with the scent of loam and musk, chops are licked, wolf whistles rend the air around her, and she is, yes, pawed, a toothsome morsel. I could eat you up. And the men are, or act like, animals. Get pregnant, and you suddenly can't find hide nor hair of 'em, scampering off, their tails between their legs, or howling at the moon, and so forth. Dense undergrowth of clichés. Perilous thicket. By the time our heroine arrives at what should be safety, she understands that she has arrived at a place of invisibility. You don't exist, or only as a cautionary tale. This is what happens if you don't moisturize. In fact, of course, she, once consumed, doesn't exist. Her grandmother, as everyone knows, is a substitute. Eaten, if not digested, the old woman is nothing but wolf fuel, replaced by the image of sexual hunger, waiting in bed with a ready answer for every question, the gaze far too avid, the interest much too spookily intense.
I love that. Spookily intense.
Yeah.
This book is spookily intense.
Thank you. But I think every one of us as women knows that moment of looking up and catching a gaze on you and realizing it's not a safe gaze. You're being looked at as possible prey.
Mm. And also, this is such a testament to the power of those first stories.
Yeah.
Those old stories about how over a lifetime you hold them up to the light and they show you something new and different and relevant, always relevant.
You can keep coming back to them, mm-hmm. but you have to come back to them, it seems to me, from a multitude of points, not just one perspective, but as mm-hmm. you can see in the book, I keep shifting because I feel like whatever the story has to tell us will only be revealed if we inhabit all the possible spaces right. in the story.
Like the way you should interpret your dreams like from every possible angle.
Exactly. Yes. Remembering, I think Roger Kamenetz might have said, you are every person in that dream.
Yes.
So you are every person in that tale.
Roger, a great dream master.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, one of the more painful parts of this book is the story of a childhood molestation by a fencing teacher and then reclaiming your interest in fencing. So would you talk a little bit about writing that? Because it's using one craft to write about another.
To write the piece, I'd fallen in love and I really wanted to be as healed as I possibly could to interact with this person I was in love with. And so that was what gave me the power to sit down and write it. And I started writing it and I was pulling the threads apart. And I should say that Roger Kamenetz's wife, the wonderful novelist Moira Crone,
yes.
is the one in the story who laughs at me and says, well, of course, you're going to have to go take a fencing class. And I was shocked and delighted, and I bustled right in to the Baton Rouge Fencing Club in order to do this. It was an amazing experience. I would say I think that when I talk about our culture not having worked through its load of grief, I would say something like one of the things that grief demands is a physical engagement with the sorrow. And you see this over and over again when you watch people try to heal from trauma. So to move into the space of taking that fencing lesson was a really important thing insofar it had so much to teach me, which I think I got into the piece itself. And mm-hmm. that delights me. And only by learning that could I then take it yet another step farther and start to think about the other aspects of what I'd learned from being molested, which were not joyful fencing lessons, but a way of being in the world that was itself abusive.
But such an elegant way to fight back.
Thank you.
You know, language, every part of it just works together as this beautiful whole in the end, you know.
I love hearing you say that. It's impossible so far for me to read that piece unless people give me a good long stretch of time mm-hmm. because it is a process. I feel like the piece yeah. is set up so that you have to go through each step in order to loosen the sorrow.
It took you a long time to be ready to write this book, but it reads like a book that was written in sustained bursts. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It has that incredible elegance, but at the same time, there's this long shadow of memory and... But it's so vivid and it's so present and immediate, you know, at the same time. It's really kind of stunning. So I'm curious about the process behind this book. Did you write like chunks of it and then sit there and wait?
That's partially the case. And then also I would say the big thing that happened with this book that was really important for me was that I said yes to my own worst issue, which is that I'm tremendously obsessive. And I just said, okay, all right, that's what I am. Let's go with that. Let's see what happens.
If that's the worst, Laura, I think. Oh.
All right. Well, it seemed like the worst then. The next book will have the new worst.
Well,
yeah.
So what did writing this book do for you? Where did it take you? How is it going to be for you to go out and perform from this book?
You know, I'm in the process of finding that out. I held the book in my hand first on November 9th. And my mother died on November 10th.
Oh, Laura, I'm so sorry.
I'm so sorry, too. And it's just maybe my other worst is that I'm brutally honest always. So I'm just going to say that and say, I think that having this book in the world and having my mother gone, they're obviously happening at the exact same time. It will be an unfolding process for me to be with this. I could say that I'm quite hopeful that the kind of wonderful conversations that you and I are having as they continue will allow me to move through the tunnel and see what's on the other side.
Well, it's such a prism. I mean, it's that kind of book you can hold up to the light and see all kinds of things. It'll be good for a lot of people to read this book.
Thank you.
I prescribe this book.
Dr. Larson.
Well, we've been talking with Laura Mullen, who directs the creative writing program at LSU, and her wonderful new book is Complicated Grief. Laura, thank you so much.
Susan, thank you so much.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Cheryl Gerber signs New Orleans, Life and Death in the Big Easy, Wednesday, December 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Kit Wool discusses and signs New Orleans icons, Iron Lace, Wednesday, December 16th at 7 at the Algiers Regional Library. Nicholas Meese discusses and signs New Orleans Hurricanes from the Start, Thursday, December 17th at 11 a.m. at the Algiers Regional Library. Marvin Allen discusses and signs Magic and a Shaker, A Year of Spirited Libations, Thursday, December 17th at 7 at the Nix Library on Carrollton. Poet Danny Kerwick reads from and signs Behind Lies the Sugar, Sunday, December 20th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. The Friends of the New Orleans Public Library have moved their book sale to the Algiers Regional Branch, 3014 Holiday Boulevard. The sale is now open 4 days a week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday, from 10 to 2. And coming up this month, the Burlesque Press presents the Hands-On Literary Festival, December 28th through 31st at the Maison St. Charles Hotel. The theme this year is the politics and power of place and space. The keynote speaker is Dorothy Allison, and other featured guests include Meredith Allen, Moira Crone, John Gary, Roger Kamenetz, Bill Lavender, Bill Lofelm, Biljana Obradovic, Daniel Wallace, and Tawny V. Waters. The panels and presentations conclude with a New Year's Eve ball. For more information or to register, check out handsonball.com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.